Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Derek Hunter is an author of 15 books, 11 works of fiction, 4 nonfiction, and the creator of a philosophy called Love Chaos. An occult practitioner, a proud dad, someone who helps those struggling with addiction, criminality, coming out of prison, in a therapeutic community and reentry program in Los Angeles, and a general seeker after the variety and depths of existence. Anonymous agnostic antichrists, passionate pilgrims, and the human drama part zero, The Fool, Frank Francine Fontaine, are three of his most recent works, released late 2023 and early 2024. Mr. W.H. will come out later this year on December 5th, an alternative novel to Anonymous Agnostic Antichrists, as both books present different possibilities regarding the Shakespeare authorship question. The human drama series began this year with The Fool, and the remaining 77 stories will continue next year, it being a 20-year project with 78 short stories for the 78 tarot cards. Derek Hunter, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much for having me on here, Victoria. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out. And, you know, I would just like to remind people when folks reach out to me that that is a possibility. Like, I'm open to folks contacting me to be on the show. You don't have to wait for an invitation. So our first question for everybody, and like, you have so much going on writing wise, like with like the current state of media and publishing, you know, why still write? Why still write books?
Well, I think that's like, I think for me, it's my, probably my biggest passion. So if in terms of a personal level, it's a thing that maybe might give me my fullest satisfaction and mm-hmm. fulfillment in my life. You know, and like, as you mentioned in my bio, I've been like seeking, you know, a wide variety of experiences in the depths of experiences and a lot of different areas since as far back as I can remember. And there's been so many kinds of experiences with other human beings, spiritual experiences, non-spiritual experiences, and just, struggles, tragedies, triumphs, and I'd say that in the midst of all those different kinds of experiences, that the one thing I can keep coming back to on a personal level is my writing, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, it's something that I always can know is there for me, that I will find some fulfillment that's consistent, you know? And, I feel like that to me is like on a personal level is an enormous reason why I continue to write. Yeah. And then in terms of outside of my own personal reasons for writing, I think that there's just so many different ways to express ourselves. Like, we can express ourselves through filmmaking, which I did in my teens and my 20s. I was a filmmaker, made some films. But also we can, you know, express ourselves through dance. We can express ourselves through painting, through all these different forms of communication and artistic expression. And I feel like that for me, it was, I love so many great authors of the past. And I really wanted to keep that hunger, that depth, that desperation for literature alive. So mm-hmm. while I did create my own philosophy of Love Chaos, most of my work is exploring literature. So literature is something for me, I feel like that needs to continue to be preserved and prize experimentation in language and storytelling in the tradition of past people, you know, like James Joyce or La Tremonte or Arthur Rimbaud, you know, and there's just so many different, or Samuel Beckett, there's so many people from the past, Sylvia Plath, just as like, I want to keep that kind of like passion for literature, like mm-hmm. alive in my own way, you know, and just in terms of how I view it, like how important literature is in terms of for us as a species. I just feel like it's extremely important, and I just don't want to see it die out. And so I just want to contribute in my own way to literature. And so for me, writing is enormously important on a personal level, but also in terms of a cultural level too. Mm-hmm.
So how, like, one of the things I think from reading this, the stuff that I read for us to prep for this, like there's such a interweaving of like the occult and your writing. So how did that come about? Like, how do they interweave for you, or how do they feed each other for you?
Well, I think that the occult is definitely a big part of my writing. You know, I feel like that it's something that, it is a, because for me, the occult is like through, whether it be through ritual or through divination, like with tarot, like I love the tarot tremendously. Like tarot readings have played an enormous part in my life. Whether it's just anything to do with like tapping into like the other side and how that relates to this world, which to me is like occult practice. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, you know, finding out the richness of the secret other side, whatever it may be, you know, and then having it interplay with this reality. I think through all the different ways that we can do that as occult practitioners. And, you know, for example, in terms of my nonfiction work, obviously like my three works on Love Chaos, deal with the occult. My third and last Love Chaos book was relating to a 6-day ritual that I did in 2020. And what the purpose of that book was to, was the survival and evolution of human beings, and just sort of feeling in a sense that our survival was, I mean, it's always been threatened throughout history, mm-hmm. but I just really wanted to do a ritual that related to something bigger than myself, you know? And so that was something very much, that's probably the one book where occult practice and my writing were most integrally like fused together. But in terms of like storytelling, in terms of writing books, novels, and short stories, I think that the connection there is an exploration of my own personal mythology. So I feel like for a practitioner, it's, and I talk about this in my Love Chaos books too, it's very important to have one's own mythology. So in terms of how you view the universe and who are the entities that are involved in terms of what they represent, you know? And so for me, my storytelling explores this mythology in depth. It would be kind of like very similar. I think the closest thing would be looking at, say, the writings and the art of William Blake. So William Blake created his own mythology, and you find it in his writing and his paintings. And so a lot of my writing, it has that my own personal mythology, you know, or Austin Osman Spare, his own mythology is in his writing and in his paintings as well. So I feel like that for me, in terms of literature, it's most definitely connected to my own occult mythology. In terms of practice, there are some rituals in my books and my stories for sure, but the rituals are more closely connected to my Love Chaos nonfiction books. But yeah, definitely that personal mythology is extremely important, I think.
Yeah. I think it's interesting what you said about like wanting to do, you know, working that bigger than yourself. Because I think this is an interesting conversation going on right now, and like witchcraft and occult spaces, about have we turned it into just like very fancy self-care instead of like kind of working for the betterment of humans. So do you want to kind of expand on that? Because I think it's an interesting idea.
Sure. Well, I mean, that was so like for up until 2020, all the rituals that I had done for those last 10 years were all very much about my individual development, right? And individual things like I struggle with addiction. I was massively enmeshed in a really bad, unhealthy lifestyle, addicted to heavy drugs, hard drugs, mm-hmm. and alcohol. So I was doing rituals when I was in that lifestyle, But then I also used magic to get me out of those addictions. Like every addiction I've ever had to hard drugs, to alcohol, to cigarettes, I used rituals to get myself out of that way of being. Right. And so I wanted in 2020 to do something bigger than myself. It just felt like occult practice is so powerful. And even though, even on an individual level, there's something I think very therapeutic in terms of wanting to have concern for something other than yourself and using our magic, using our practice for something bigger than ourselves. So, you know, obviously that's like in that 6-day ritual that I did was very like ambitious. And how am I, who am I to presume to want to help human beings survive and evolve? But I think there's something, really valuable there for us to want to do something for our species. You know, I think there's something valuable to want to do for animals, for this planet, for maybe for outside even this planet, for other forms of existence outside of this into the universe. I think we can do rituals for so many different reasons, you know, and I think it doesn't have to just be about ourselves. Oh.
All right, the podcat made his presence known. no, I think that makes sense to me. The I think it is, you know, I think part of our nature to want to be in community, and part of that is looking at like examining what that means, what community actually means, like how big are you willing to think about what that word means?
Absolutely. Right. Like just like your friend right there, you know, it definitely, I think an extension of our loved ones can extend beyond human beings for sure. Mm-hmm. And the emotional connection that we can have with other animals is enormous.
Yeah.
You know, it's huge. And I think that empathy, I think that's a thing with, I think empathy can be an enormously powerful tool for transformation. It doesn't have to be seen as some kind of like weak thing, you know, like, I mm-hmm. guess there might be some practitioners who are like into power and money and success and all this other thing. And they view things like compassion and empathy as somehow weak or something. I think it's actually the opposite. I think that empathy, compassion and understanding are enormously powerful. And we can use those for rituals as well, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of my writing too. So like a lot of my writing can be very dark and deals with a lot of pain and anguish, and the characters and the stories have their struggles. But I always like, for me, I always want, and I want it to come out naturally through the narrative and not force it. But I always feel like it's very important to show that aspect of human beings, that we have that capacity for growth, for personal growth, for communal growth, for reaching out to others, to triumph, even in the midst of tragedy. We can still have that capacity for, you know, the beauty of life.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that is really nice. I agree with you about, you know, I think this idea that compassion and empathy are weak seems counterintuitive to me personally, just because I feel like the more you open up and care about things, the more you personally can be hurt. Right. Mm. And so I think, you know, it is braver and stronger to be compassionate and open and empathetic, because you're opening yourself up to other people's experiences, which can be incredibly painful or beautiful, you know?
Mm-hmm. And being able to open up to that being hurt, but being able to process that hurt, you know, I think is a sign of strength, you know? And that's what I do at my job when I help these individuals coming out of prison, is that a lot of them, you know, because of how institutionalized they've been, a lot of them have been, since they were young, you know, institutionalized in juvenile halls and stuff like that. And then they, you know, coming from broken homes and joining gangs and all the violence that they experience, it's like that vulnerability is something that they really struggle with. And so I try to, through our group process and things like that we do, which is very, it was really big for me too, doing group work, is something that I feel you can allow yourself to have a certain degree of vulnerability, never let go of being protective of oneself for sure, but you can find a way where you can still open up your heart to others while protecting yourself too, and growing through that pain too, you know, when people do hurt our feelings, because it happens all the time. We're constantly hurting each other's feelings.
Yeah. And, you know, also part of the human condition, unfortunately. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm curious, a little bit of a 180, I guess, but like, how did you get interested in this idea of the Shakespeare authorship question?
Sure, absolutely. Well, so just for folks to know, that I have been madly in love with Shakespeare for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. So I was first introduced to Shakespeare as a young boy because my stepfather, who, while he had some good qualities, he wasn't physically abusive, but he was verbally abusive, and he did other things that were very traumatic for me. He was a former Shakespeare actor, and he also used to love singing musical tunes. So when he would introduce Shakespeare to me, I didn't like it. And I guess my relationship with him was complicated.
Yeah.
But when I went to high school, my first year of high school, I met an English teacher, and the English teacher was absolutely amazing. And with him and his wife, it was like three teachers, him and his wife and another teacher who was more of a creative writing teacher. But him and his wife were like, you know, English literature and history teachers. And I was just like, absolutely fell in love with Shakespeare. This was like, wow, these stories are exciting, you know? I think that's the key thing, is if you have someone who's like the gatekeeper to Shakespeare, who is passionate about themselves, and they break down the stories to you first, and then you can get into the language, and then you can get into the character development. It's like, if you can just once you know what's going on in the stories, then you can get engaged, and then you're like pulled in. And so ever since then, I've just been madly in love with Shakespeare. The following year, my sophomore year, I had to write a biography on Shakespeare. And so I forget what class it was for. It was a different class. And so I had to write this biography on Shakespeare. And I started reading like the biographies about Shakespeare. I read like a few, and I was reading them, and I was just like enormously disappointed, hugely disappointed. This was at a time too, when my freshman and sophomore year, I was also falling in love with James Joyce, with Arthur Rimbaud and Dostoevsky. And those three in particular, their personal life stories had a very strong connection to their work. Like James Joyce in particular, who to this day is one of my favorites. And just, you see where this person is going in their own personal development, where they're going from this phase of their life to the next. And in Arthur Rimbaud very much too, and Dostoevsky. And like in most writers, most artists, you see that personal connection. And I loved biographies. I loved knowing who this person was, and like bands that I loved. I loved like finding out more about the bands. Like when I fell in love with The Cure, I wanted to know more about Robert Smith. Or when I fell in love with Nine Inch Nails, I wanted to know more about Trent Reznor, you know? And so it was just like this thing of like, I wanted to know the person behind the works. And I just was enormous. It wasn't as if there wasn't anything there. We do know things about Shakespeare, the man from Stratford, but it is completely opposite of an artistic life. So mm-hmm. In terms of just evidence, historical evidence of this person, they were a cutthroat businessman. They were extremely greedy at a time when other people were suffering. There was a famine happening in his hometown of Stratford, and he hoarded the grain. And he didn't pay his taxes. If people owed him money, even the smallest amounts, he would just ruthlessly come after them for that small amount. There's no evidence he had any books. His will was obsessed with just tiny little details about really superficial stuff. No mention at all of anything creative. His daughters were illiterate. His wife was illiterate. His parents were illiterate. The only signatures that we, only thing we have in by him in writing is six signatures that all seem to be written by other people. He was very much a social climber. He wanted to get, his family name out there. He owned enormous properties. And so it was just all these, and I would be okay, like in a way of like, well, maybe if I don't like this person, but then there'd be something else. And the thing about it was that at the time, there's actually evidence of like these other authors at the time where they actually had like a quite a vivid, a creative life. There was a lot of back and forth between authors, a lot of competition between authors. A lot of them would be making fun of each other or putting each other down or something. You know, there'd be something there. Some of them would dedicate, you know, works to each other. And you don't have that with Shakespeare, you know, even though all these have been centuries and centuries of trying to find something that would show some kind of life that was artistic. And there's not. Everything that you have to do as a biographer for Shakespeare to find that, you have to make it up. You have to, like, all the biographies about Shakespeare, if they want to express, you know, explore the creative process, it's all make-believe. It's all conjecture. It's conjecture. It's like, well, he must have been doing this or he must have been doing that. And people want to say, well, it's because it was so long ago. It just isn't, you know, we don't know much about him. And that's not true. Like, there was people at the time where we have a paper trail of a creative life. And even if you go back further in time to Dante, you know, to the early 14th century, around the early 1300s, you see Dante writing his works, and there's a strong personal connection between what he was writing and his own personal life. So it's not that it was far back in time. That's why we don't have any evidence of a creative life. It's just for me personally, I just don't think he had anything to do with the creative process. I think that his name was being used, which was the case in those days. A lot of people were using others' names. You know, it was something that, so from that point on, it was like a 30-year search to, like, well, okay, if it wasn't Shakespeare, then who was it, you know? And that's what took me down this long rabbit hole of trying to find out who the person was. And that was a whole long journey of just reading, talking to people, going to lectures, getting into many debates and arguments with people, and changing my mind like thousands of times, and the story that I wanted to write changing thousands of times because I changed my idea of who it was, you know. But I had a deadline that on December 5th of 2023, I would publish the book, and it would be a work of fiction because I just didn't feel like I wanted it to be a nonfiction work. I wanted it to be a story. So by December 5th of 2023, and I picked that date because it was the 400th anniversary of the publication of Shakespeare's first folio in 1623.
Yeah.
So we don't know exactly when it was published, but there's a record for the first sale to a young antiquarian named Edward Daring. On December 5th, he wrote down records that he bought two copies of the first folio. Both were extremely expensive, but one, like, the most expensive, and then the second version of it was less expensive. But he bought two copies on December 5th of 1623. And so the story basically explores how those poetry were written from the perspective of one main character, Thomas North, but that he had also a lot of collaborators who helped him along the way. Like a good, I would say, two dozen other authors who helped him to write those plays and poetry. And so I published that last year on December 5th of 2023.
Yeah. And reading, like I said, I read a pretty good chunk of that. And I just wanted to kind of dip into as many of your things as I could before we talked. But one of the things that I hadn't thought about, and I mean, I've always kind of wondered about the Shakespeare question, just because, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's just been this discussion forever about the authorship, right? So it's like, there's probably something there. But I had not thought about the court intrigue aspect of it, about the writers who were doing the plays just for the courts.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Just for court. And that there was this whole, like, kind of writing community around that. And that would have been part of it. I mean, it was such a volatile time politically. So it makes sense that they would have wanted to set, because a lot of Shakespeare's plays are political, or the plays that we think are Shakespeare plays, I guess, in context of our conversation. But there was so much political intrigue in them. You probably did want to cover your butt.
Right. Well, I mean, it was just not the thing to do. So, like, there's this one play called Garbaduck, which was written by Thomas Sackville and Thomas Norton. And they wrote it in the early 1560s, the early stage of Queen Elizabeth's reign. And it was a court play. And people should keep in mind that public theaters were not created until the late 1570s. So I think it was like the first theater was called the theater. Mm-hmm. And it was like 1577, 78, around that time. So plays were all, you know, private performances. They were meant for the courts or the inns of court for the legal world. And so you did not, as a courtier, like a member of the court, Queen Elizabeth's court, you just did not put your name to things like plays or even poetry. Like you wouldn't give it to the public. You wouldn't publish it to the public. It was just not something that you did. It was like a social thing. So like, for example, so that play, Garbaduck, it was published in 1563. And Thomas Sackville he was enormously angry at the people who did it, who took his play that he did with Norton. And he was very angry that it was published, because that was just not, it wasn't his, he didn't want it to be published. He didn't want his name associated with the play. He was a statesman. He was a political maneuverer. He was in that world. So there was the element of the social aspect of it, like just not being something you did. Because then you kind of, people look at you kind of weird, like, what are you doing? But then there is also the other element that you're talking about, which is the dangerous element in terms of who you might offend. Mm-hmm. So that was enormous back in those days. You know, you had to be very careful, not just to offend the queen, but then you had to be very careful not to offend anyone else who had power, right? Any aristocrat who got offended by it. There's a lot of people who were on the lookout to make sure that they were not being, you know, made fun of or satirized or criticized, or, you know, so the authors were, when they were writing the plays for the public theaters by the 1580s, everything was anonymous. The most famous at the time, not now, but famous at the time, and the most popular play at the time was a play called The Spanish Tragedy. And we now know it was written by Thomas Kidd. But at the time, and all the many different times it was published, and all the many times it was performed, it never had an author's name attached to it. It was always just an anonymous play. Mm-hmm. And that was from during when it was first published in 1592, all the way up until when the Puritans closed down the theaters in 1641, it was the most popular play during that time. Yeah. So during the Shakespeare period, after the Shakespeare period, before it, like, this is the most popular play. And so it was just like, you had to be very careful, because you could upset certain people, you know, and you had to be very mindful. And then also too, the aristocrats themselves used the plays too. So the Earl of Leicester, who was Queen Elizabeth's like favorite person, probably lover, they were probably most likely lovers. And he really wanted to get married to her and become her king, right? And so he used plays to help promote his agenda. So sometimes that would be like, so the playwrights would be used to promote a political agenda of that aristocrat. Mm-hmm. And then that might, then they, and then he might want the playwright to introduce criticisms of his enemies at court. So there might be a character that might be making fun of somebody else, like the Earl of Oxford or someone else, you know? So there was just like a lot of, so authors are very careful for those two reasons, for the social reason, and then also to protect themselves. And I really think when you start seeing authors' names attached to plays and to poetry in the 1590s, one of the reasons was that the authorities wanted to know who wrote what. So then they know who to punish.
Right.
So if they know so and so Ben Jonson wrote this play, they're like, okay, we're gonna go after Ben Jonson and torture him until you know, and he tells us which aristocrat told him to write this play. And so there was a lot going on at the time. There was a lot of tension, you know, there was a lot of tension between the Catholics mm-hmm. and the Protestants. Mm-hmm. People's lives, you know, people were being killed for writing or saying the wrong thing. So people had to be very careful.
I would say Elizabeth didn't hesitate to send people to the Tower. Like that was not.
Right. Well, it, she did a lot of great stuff, but she did a lot of bad stuff too. And like, and speaking on that, there was a guy, his last name was Stubbs, right? And he wrote this pamphlet and he was reading it out in the streets of London, that he was so upset that she would even consider marrying a Frenchman, that she had to be loyal to her English people, marry an English man. And so he was wrote this pamphlet and he was kind of promoting this, and she got so pissed off at him. She had his writing hand be cut off. And then I forget what she cut off his hand, and she made some weird dark joke about his name being Stubbs. So now you have a stub, Mr. Stubbs.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So one of the things I thought was interesting in the book is, I mean, I think, you know, if you're even remotely interested in like the occult and history, you know that like John Dee and the court astrologers and all that kind of swirls around Elizabeth's reign. And I thought it was interesting in the book how you kind of pluck that occult thread into, because I haven't really heard that discussion much about William Shakespeare's authorship. So I think pulling that thread out was kind of interesting to do, especially for folks who haven't read it, to kind of give them an idea of how those things kind of interweave a little bit, maybe.
Sure. So the occult thread in Shakespeare's works. Absolutely. I definitely think when you brought up John Dee, I think that the thing with John Dee is that he was definitely not the only one who was an occult practitioner back there by any means. I think it was a fairly common thing. And I think that, so in terms of the person who, you know, in terms of anonymous agnostic antichrist, I definitely think that the Thomas North and these others, especially Christopher Marlowe, were occult practitioners themselves. And I definitely think that you can find reasons to believe so in the plays and poetry themselves. And I think one of the, you know, Hamlet's definitely one of the most autobiographical characters, I think, in the canon. But I also, another enormously autobiographical character is Prospero. And so Prospero is a wizard. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of plays at the time that presented wizards and generally presented them in such a way where they could have positive qualities, but by the end, you had to show that there was something wrong or evil with what they were doing with their occult practice. Mm-hmm. And so with Prospero, you don't find that. So there's two other examples. There's a play by Robert Greene, which is called Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay. So Roger Bacon and this other friar, and they're kind of at odds with each other. And Friar Bacon is a wizard, and he's shown to be really powerful and does all these things, but he's shown that his occult practice ultimately leads him to evil. And so that the nature of occult practice of ritual is evil. And then also the most famous one is Dr. Faustus. So in Christopher Marlowe's play, Dr. Faustus, as much as we may like Dr. Faustus, I definitely don't think he's as likable as Goethe's version of Faust. Goethe's version of Faust is far more complex and interesting. But in Marlowe's, you do have some empathy towards Dr. Faustus. But even with him, he's ultimately like a lesson to be learned not to to dabble in the occult arts, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you do so, you're going to be in league with the devil and you're going to go straight to hell. Now in Prospero, in the play, The Tempest, right, with Shakespeare's name on it, that is not the case at all. Prospero, his magic doesn't lead to anything evil. It's all presented in such a way where it's beneficial, and Prospero is this powerful wizard, but it's nothing like, it's not going to hell. He's not, you know, there's nothing wrong really with the occult. And then and there's a lot of other things that you can find too. Midsummer Night's Dream, where you have, you know, the fairies and, you know, you have this element of the supernatural, but they're not really, none of the supernatural entities are doing anything really destructive.
Yeah, it kind of messes with people, but it all washes out in the end.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and so I think there's that element. And I definitely feel like, too, in terms of, and you read enough to know, like, I also feel like that there were definitely secret orders at the time mm-hmm. that were playing, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And so the two that are in that book, I made them up. They're not historical. Mm-hmm. The Futurum and also to R. Arcadia. So there's the two. The Futurum was for men and R. Arcadia was for women. And so you had people like Emilia Lanier or Mary Sidney Herbert belonging to R. Arcadia. And then you had Thomas North and others who belonged to the Futurum, and North's father, who was, you know, was the uncle to Etienne de Boetie. Boetie was a Frenchman, a very radical Frenchman, anarchist in thought in a lot of ways, and dear friend to Montaigne. So there's a lot more to it than that, but I really feel like that there was people playing behind the scenes, making things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this for that time, people have to understand the majority of plays were lost during that time. There's a lot of authors who were lost. There's probably many playwrights who were working at the time we don't know of. Mm-hmm. A lot of plays were lost. And so the Shakespeare canon was preserved. And I think that there were people who wanted it to be preserved. And my book explores it, that they were more of a progressive nature, and they felt that the Shakespeare canon was sort of a response to the, I think, in terms of the reactionary religious institutions and machinations. So it was something like where you can use these plays and poetry more than just entertainment, but also ways to continue the light of progressive elements in terms mm-hmm. of human beings. I definitely feel like that the Shakespeare canon, the plays and poetry, prizes that element. And it's kind of in response to the darkness and the evil of, I think, a lot of religious teachings.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about two things. The kind of to backtrack to saying, you know, your high school English teacher introduced you to this love of Shakespeare and the plays and literature, and like how many writers, like you don't have to look very far behind the curtain to find like an English teacher from right. high school or elementary school. And just that idea that all of this that you've talked about like came from that, you know, that encounter in high school with a teacher who loved Shakespeare, you know, and then also just this idea of how when you start to like look at all those layers of what was going on at the time, like with how plays were produced and like this moving to the public and becoming a public entertainment and how that changed from the court entertainments. And just this idea that we have that, you know, Shakespeare, those plays that we think about now as like these great works of literature were like at the time public entertainment, like going to a movie, you know, they weren't that. And I think that's why, you know, when people are like, well, how did we lose all this stuff? It was like, because it was like the BBC erasing early television. Nobody thought anybody would care about what happened to these things. So the things that we do have either by design, like you're talking about with the folio, or by happenstance, mean more in our context than they probably did in their own context in some ways.
Absolutely. Yes. I think it's an extremely important point to make, because I think you have to look at in terms of historical perspective, in terms of now we see like here's Shakespeare on this enormous, you know, pedestal, right? The highest creative pedestal you could possibly imagine. Like nobody can read Shakespeare. Well, that's not how it came to people at the time.
Right.
It wasn't served like these plays and these poetry wasn't served like here is this greatest work of art, you know, that to match what they did in ancient Rome or ancient Greece, you know, it wasn't presented in that way. It was like the theaters, the public theaters in particular, were associated with the lowest possible elements to society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had just enormous criminality going on, you know, from thieves to vagabonds, to prostitution, to just all kinds of varieties of crime. It was the lowest dregs of society. Mm-hmm. But it was weird because you had like, it was associated with like the bottom of society. And yet there was this great poetry that was being introduced to the public. And so it's important to know that most people in those days were illiterate. Most people didn't know how to read and write. That was like the common thing. So I think that the people in power, like Elizabeth and her men and others, wanted to educate their people. They wanted to educate their people and also to develop the English language in such a way to make it just as important as the continental languages, just as important as French, just as important as Italian, just as important as Latin, or, you know, as Spanish and other continental languages, to make a name for themselves, right? It was really important for English language to be known. So, and also, I think, you know, like Elizabeth was very much about educating her people because so many of her aristocrats were still Catholic. So she needed to have support. And so in order to have that support, it was like, well, let's educate the lower classes and bring them up. So she had public schools like Westminster or the Merchant Taylor School were open to the lower classes. And there were basically opportunities for educating people who normally wouldn't have education, mm-hmm. you know? And so a lot of playwrights came from that, from those schools and went on to university. So there was this big push to educate the public. And one of the ways you could do it was through plays, because even if you didn't know how to read or write, you could still listen. You can hear language. You could still see the actors on stage and these stories, mm-hmm. and you could still kind of start to pick up new words. You hear these words being spoken on stage, beautifully written. And it was a way to create an English culture that that would continue to grow. So they saw it as a way, not only as an entertainment tool, but as an educational tool for the people. But yeah, these plays, the plays and even the poetry, like the two narrative poems were very scandalous. They're erotic poems. Mm-hmm. So you have Venus and Adonis and the Rape of Lucrece, where both of them are about sex. And so it's they weren't coming at people from like this, like here's this great work of art to be used, that's okay for it to be in a church, right? Like, no, mm-hmm. like these plays and these poetries, they had nothing to do with religion. They had nothing to do with Christianity. They were, you know, quite, they were very earthy, scandalous, sexy, entertaining. Mm-hmm. But within that framework, you had this depth of philosophical insight, and that's where we the richness to it, that this mm-hmm. the depth to it, which we continue to cherish. But that it didn't happen right away. I think people got a sense of it at the time, but because it was presented in the way it was through the plays, it wasn't like they weren't seeing it the way they do now. And it really wasn't until the German Romantics, who really put Shakespeare on a whole other pedestal and turned Shakespeare into this literary god. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Goethe and the other Germans that were like, these romantic poets were like, wow, Shakespeare is like the best. Yeah. You know, up until that time, it was like people liked him and appreciated him, but it wasn't, the pedestal part didn't happen until a couple hundred years later.
Yeah. So I guess, this is maybe kind of a strange question, but like in thinking about that and like Shakespeare's work at the time, or, you know, things attributed to Shakespeare and where that is now kind of in public esteem, like, does it make you think about like the longevity of your own work?
Well, I think that I think it's really important for all of us to think about not just in terms of where we are now, but what we're going to leave behind. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really, you know, we want to affect the present day as much as possible, but I really feel like it. We should think about whatever we create, whether we're artists or scientists or in the field of law or in politics. You know, we should really think about the future. You know, like mm-hmm. what are we leaving behind? What did we do in our life that we can be feel proud of on a personal level, but then also too how it can affect human beings in terms of our development? Like, how can we help to further our progress? You know, and so for me, like as a writer, I try to do my best, you know, and I really want the works to last after I die. That's very important for me, you know, because I feel like that is, I'm not chasing after book sales. I'm not chasing after being a super popular writer, you know, like that to me is not important. I really want to make a mark as much as I can as an author while I'm alive. But I'm also, I probably even more so is just in terms of thinking of how can my work live on and create some kind of mark in the future, if not more so than today. Mm-hmm. So posterity, I think, is really important, like on so many different levels. I think we think it's good to think about what we're going to leave behind and try to leave behind something that is really as meaningful as possible.
No, that makes sense. Well, yeah, I feel like there's just so much like we could go deep on. We do try to keep the podcast to an hour. But I did want to give you, we have a little game of chance question at the end and we'll get to that. But before we do, I wanted to give you an opportunity, maybe in that vein, a little bit what we were just talking about, to just kind of tell people where they can find your work or more about you or how you would like people to engage with your stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Well, definitely the best place to go would be my website, which would be love-chaos.com. So love-chaos.com. All my work is on there. And also I'm most active on social media, on Instagram, and also on Facebook. There is a Love Chaos Facebook group that has about 1,500 members to it. And so there's a lot of activity on there. Those are the two places that if you're on social media, it would be that Facebook Love Chaos group, or mm-hmm. You can find me on Instagram. And both of them are on that website there. And in terms of, you know, what I have coming up to look forward to, so that book, Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, being a hardcore agnostic, I'm all about possibilities. So that theory that Thomas North and these other people wrote, the Shakespeare canon, I'm actually writing right now as we speak an alternative novel, which takes Francis Bacon's older brother, Anthony Bacon, as the true author of the plays and poetry with Shakespeare's name on them. And so it'll be following his life story from birth until death and having him being the true author of the work. So I'm currently writing that. And that novel is called Mr. W.H. And that will be published on the 1-year anniversary of Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist on December 5th of this year of 2024. So, and then after that, starting in the spring equinox of next year, I'll get back to the Tarot short story series, which is 78 short stories for the 78 tarot cards. The first one has already been released. It was released on the spring equinox of this year, Fool. So next year I'll get back into that, and then I'll mm-hmm. be plunging full on to that very ambitious 20-year project. We'll go get back into that next year.
Yeah, that's a long set to put yourself up for, but
yes,
the start is interesting. The start of it was interesting. I didn't know what to expect when I jumped in, and I was like, okay, this is an interesting opening gambit. So I'm curious to see where it goes. Great. So, and I'll put links for all that in the show notes so people can, you know, have easy access to it. Great. And I guess I'll just to remind people, like, we also have transcripts for all the episodes if people need those. So I feel like we dropped a lot of names there. A transcript might help.
So. Yeah, I know. I throw out a lot of names and people might, but yeah, definitely any names you hear, definitely check them out. I feel like history is definitely, there's just so much to explore, and it's worth mm-hmm. looking back at the past and seeing all the people who came before, because there's so many lives that are worth exploring.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like sometimes, you know, when you're in like that witchcraft occult space, you kind of get some tunnel vision and read mostly people writing in that space. And I think stepping outside of that into history and folklore and, you know, can feed your work and your practice as much as anything else. And
absolutely. 100%. Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. All right. So I'm going to roll our die and see what we get. So 3, religion. Are you up for that?
Okay.
Awesome. I should have given you more of the rules. I kind of jumped ahead. But anyway, I roll the die. And depending on what I get, you get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Uh-huh.
So are you good with religion or do we need to go on?
Sure,
to something else?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
So I was thinking when I try to write new questions for all the guests, and I was thinking about your work, especially with folks coming out of incarceration. And so how do you feel like your practice as an occultist feeds that work? Because I feel like you do have to have a well to draw on to do that kind of work. So how is that part of it for you, or where does that come from for you?
Well, it's definitely, so in terms of the nature of the word occult or esoteric, in terms of being secretive, like secret knowledge, mm-hmm. at my job, because so many of the people that I work with and the people I help are religious, the majority mm-hmm. are Christian, I keep my occult practice like very secretive. Mm-hmm. So the way it informs my work is definitely a very hidden nature. I have to be very careful not to be too explicit mm-hmm. and exoteric about it, right? I can't be, they can go on and praise Jesus and all this other stuff and so forth, right? And mm-hmm. And it's just, it's that sort of Christian privilege that, you know, it's a lot less so these days, but I mean, it definitely was a lot more so before. Mm-hmm. But that's what it is. So I have to be very careful with how, what I say. A lot of them do know that I do have my occult practice. I'm interested in that. And then they know my name. So then they go and look up my works on Amazon and they can see like, oh, okay. What's this stuff? But it definitely, my occult practice definitely informs my work. So for me, it's very important that the love that I have for other human beings is also, it comes from a place of a certain degree of protection and power for myself. So the work that I do with entities, my daily practice, you know, a lot of it is very important on a protective element. So when you're going into an environment where people coming out of prison, coming from a very traumatized life, you know, you've heard the word, you know, hurt people.
Yeah.
So you've heard that phrase, hurt people, hurt people. So a lot of these are ex-gang members I'm dealing with, people, some of them, quite a few I've worked with have killed people. So you coming from a brutal, very brutal institutionalized environment such as prison. So for me, what's really helped me a lot is to, for my work, my occult work, to empower myself, because I have to feel a certain degree of power mm-hmm. in that environment, because it to balance the compassion, to balance the empathy that I have for these men coming out of prison, working with them, because I have to be, it's important to show vulnerability, but I have to be protective of myself too at the same time, because it can be a very challenging environment to work in, very challenging work. But a lot of my occult practice is not only just about helping myself, but it's also about helping others, you know. And I think that's my philosophy of Love Chaos, is that the main focus is love. You know, that's, to me, is the ultimate expression is love. And you know, we live in this chaotic universe, this universe filled with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unpredictability. And it's, to me, it's neutral. It's not, it sometimes it can be harmful, sometimes it can be beneficial. So we just happen to live in that unpredictable universe. And in that environment that I work in, that campus I work in, 180 of these men and my coworkers too, there's just so much unpredictability, so much just like stuff just happens out of the blue, right? Yeah. And you just have a lot of traumatized people bouncing around. So just being okay and knowing to work within that uncertain paradigm, but focusing on love. So that has helped me tremendously in the work that I do, where I work, you know, and just in my life in general too. It just helps me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the opposite has happened to you? Like your work has like then impacted your practice?
I think that what I like about it is that they're like these two different worlds in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. like on the surface level, they're very different worlds. So like my writing is very much about what I'm into and my own personal vision, and expressing that through literature, through stories, and through nonfiction, through the philosophy of love, chaos. So I keep them very separate. So I think that the world I work in terms of the helping these people coming from prison to reenter society, I feel that having them separate in that way keeps them from affecting my occult work in a negative way. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that, I haven't experienced, I've definitely had experienced negative reactions to my work, and people have been very critical of me and over the years of my work and not liked my work. But generally I found that to be people, whether it be, in the world of Shakespeare or in the world of the occult, people who don't like agnosticism, don't like the work that I do. But in terms of the world of the helping field, helping people, I haven't experienced anything, nothing has really come into that world where they've had a negative impact. So mm-hmm. I keep them separate. I don't like to bring my work into my personal work into my job. I keep them the two separate.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, I was just thinking about what you said about, criticism of your work. And I think it's one of the things that I think coming to writing or to publishing, I guess, really, because, you can write forever, no one else see it. But coming to publishing and putting yourself out there, I think that it can be a challenge, especially with the first thing you publish, to realize that there are people who are just going to hate your work and they're going to want to tell you about it. And I think that can be a challenge for newly published folks. Is there, it's kind of a left field question from religion, but how do you deal with the criticism?
I've even had some death threats. So it's
oh my gosh.
I know it's, and I've actually, even recently, one of the people who I thought was, I won't go into that, but there's somebody who, I won't tell who it was, but there was somebody who I thought was really supportive of my work. And they really didn't like Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist because they didn't portray Thomas North in the way they wanted it to. Mm-hmm. And so that one was kind of hurtful because it was from somebody I kind of was hoping to have some more support from. But definitely when it comes from people who I don't know, even if it's death threats, it hurts for sure. I'll be honest. It hurts. It definitely hurts. And I feel kind of there's a bit of fear too, what the hell? Mm-hmm. But I think that it kind of comes with the work that we do. When you put your voice out there and you try to be different, you just try to express yourself in your own way, you're going to upset somebody. Somebody's going to take it the wrong way. Someone's going to just see you as some kind of threat. And I feel you just have to kind of just go with it. I think it's important to acknowledge the hurt feelings. A lot of people's anger comes from hurt feelings. And so, I've struggled with anger throughout my life, and I've come to see that underlying the anger is just having my feelings hurt, by somebody did something that was hurtful to me. So being able to process those hurt feelings, I think is enormous, on a personal level, but also as a writer, and just knowing that it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And just reminding myself that there are people whose opinions I respect enormously, who love my work, And so I think for a new writer just starting out, just know that you will find somebody. You will find somebody out there who is going to really love your work and appreciate your work. You just have, it may take, took me a long time. My own personal journey as a writer has had enormous neglect and rejection over periods of three decades, of just a long periods of just no appreciation at all. So I just hung in there. I guess I just was hanging in there, and even to this day, the level of appreciation of my work is still pretty minimal. But at least there are people I know out there who do like my work. And I think that helps tremendously. There were times where I got I was really in dark spaces in my head in terms of my own ability as a writer, and just and then when you commit yourself so strongly to something and no one's responding, it hurts, you know, it really definitely hurts. But if you love what you do, just know, I think as a writer, that's just the path. It's just, you have to understand that's a big part of what the writer's life is about, is rejection and neglect. It just, it's just part of it.
Yeah. I keep going. I keep at it. Yeah.
You keep at it. Yeah. But yeah. Oh, in terms of religion though, I don't know. Yeah. Religion. So wait, would you say, like, in terms of religion, like, there's just so much to discuss there. What would I, should I talk about it and how it relates to my own work?
I mean, we're kind of wrap it up, but yeah, if you want to.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, just so people know, like, I'm as I've mentioned it already, I'm very agnostic and I'm very much about embracing doubt. If there is any kind of religious tenet that I have, it would be that. If my father, he wrote a play called Waiting for Amanda, and it's the last thing he wrote before he died, my biological father, in 2005. Mm-hmm. And I have that on my website. And he had this phrase in the play. It was called, one of the characters talks about a religion called the religion of many doubts. Mm-hmm. And when I created Love Chaos in 2014, which technically is a religion of agnosticism and love in a chaotic universe, that was a big influence on me. Mm-hmm. And I definitely find value in a lot of different religions, for sure. There's a lot of religions, a lot of things in religions that I don't like and very critical of. These anonymous agnostic antichrists and the upcoming book, Mr. W.H., both explore the historical aspect of the negative aspect of religion, in particular Christianity. So it explores how religion is definitely can be a very destructive force in people's lives.
Yeah. Oh, but I love that. The religion of doubts, of many doubts. Yeah. I mean, I don't identify 100% as agnostic, but I always lean that way.
Yeah, my dad was a great, great person. I wish he lived longer. He didn't get a chance to write and complete a lot of his ideas, but you know, he was a huge influence on me, and he was agnostic. And it's a core of who I am, for sure.
Awesome. Well, Derek, thank you so much for reaching out. Thanks for coming on the show. And I would encourage people to check out your work. I mean, you did say there are some dark elements, so I do want to let people know it is not a cozy read.
Yes. A lot of my work does explore very painful experiences, and Anonymous Agnostic Antichrist, it explores the lead character, Thomas North, when he was young. He had some very traumatic experiences, extremely traumatic. And so just to be on the lookout, a lot of my work does explore trauma. I am a victim of trauma myself, as a child, sexual abuse. And so something that I can relate to. It's a healing process. So I think that for me, exploring painful experiences is a cathartic act. And it's because when I didn't do that, I did the opposite. Hold that stuff in. It has to come out some way. So when I would hold it in, it would come out in unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
So I think by either talking about it in therapeutic ways or writing about it in stories is a very healthy thing. But yes, definitely. When you read my books, just be aware that there are some dark stuff, and my writing style is unusual as well. There's a lot of surreal aspects.
I can see a lot of Joyce in your work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Joyce and Rimbaud are huge, huge influences on me for sure. And Lautremont too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you, and good luck with all your work in both your mundane life and your writing life.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk about all this great stuff here, Victoria. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being curious and open-minded.
Thanks.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com. And you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.